First of all, thank you everybody for bearing with this session as we started about 10 minutes late, and I'll do my best to keep us on a revised schedule. You know, the interesting thing to me about what's already happened today, if you look at history, when we go back, and we started, of course, with the origin of the universe, with Bob McCarthy, and then our last presenter showed us, we really went into the Wayback Machine. I'm going to confine a retrospective look just for the last couple of decades. And we're going to view some of these ideas through the lens, twin lens actually, of two prior conferences very similar to this one. 1988, the first Sound Reinforcement Conference in Nashville, and 1994, the AES 13th in Dallas, Texas, which was all about computer-controlled sound systems. So I'll confine my comments to what's gone on in about three decades. I'm going to stick to a focus on portable live sound, reinforcing for concerts and events, rather than a lot of what we just heard discussed by Dr. Start and Mr. Hines and Mr. Hendry downstairs, which was pretty much applicable to the installed field. And I'll be referring to multiple modular boxes and arrays. Just to remind those of you who have never actually driven a truck, loaded it, unloaded it, set it up, climbed the scaffolding, this is what many of us were doing in the early to mid-1980s. So there's a picture from Recording Engineer Producer Magazine, 1983, 90 modular boxes on a sound wing, so you'd have these large monolithic columns left and right. I'm not going to be showing a lot of beautiful pictures of large speakers. Rather, I'm going to focus on the technical trends, sort of the seminal developments that have started to converge, and the paradigm shift that has occurred due to the development efforts of many people in this room. Most recent advances, of course, which are taking us in an interesting direction, higher onboard amplifier channel count within each loudspeaker box in the array, which enables higher resolution steerable array technology, similar to what the gentlemen were discussing in the last session. Okay, at the 88 conference, how to leverage this relatively newly available personal computer as a control mechanism for loudspeaker arrays was a hot topic, and a new serial interface developed by IED was highlighted. Conference ended, the final speech by Clifford Henriksen postulated that computers would soon run, monitor, and control large systems. Speakers would become more clever. Smart speakers is what Clifford was talking about. Now, at the time of that conference, user interface and control system was almost exclusively focused on the mixing console and the need to capture cue programming for live events. As you see, the Grammy Awards there, the early Solid State Logic Total Recall system. I included the Amiga 500 because Charlie of Richmond Sound Designs had a very innovative product platform. He based it on a technology platform from outside the audio industry, which became obsolete. So it really made him have to scramble to find a new platform for the interface that he was working with. Programmable DSP and digital integration was a hot topic. On the right there, you see the Clare TC Electronics remote controlled EQ system, interfacing with a PC and also a mechanical head with moving faders that you could walk out onto the stage. But at this time, most of the processing, crossovers, delay units were individual hardware units, and Rich Cabot, a past president of the society, hypothesized that we would see equalizers that combined all of these functions in one set of hardware, and that better computers would help us get there. Well, that brought up the real core question. Well, how do you control different audio devices with a computer? What's the best way to do this? And I think we're still looking for the answer to that question today, aren't we? At any rate, a group of manufacturers, one of the prime movers, of course, being Bob Rogers, Altec Lansing. He actually developed the device control language, and this was ratified in 1991 for the PA422 standard, how to use a computer to control a programmable audio device. Well, many of the manufacturers, here you see the Crown IQ 2000 system, it was like an arms race. Crest, Crown, and QSC were all trying to capitalize on the need to have a large control network for multiple amplifiers, as many as 200 in a typical large-scale stadium installation. So this is what began to economically drive the ability to interface with the system. Now, Ben is here, Ben Koch, and he was one of the co-inventors of a system that was far ahead of its time from Stage a Company, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But look at the highlighted quote here from his team's AES paper presentation from the Paris Convention, AES 84th. Existing computer interfaces and protocols are unsuited for pro audio applications or suffer from high complexity and cost. So that's why SANET was developed. And the interesting thing is that interesting to me at least, the time it took for the audio industry to integrate these different available technology platforms that were evolving outside of audio at companies like Microsoft and Intel, it actually gave an entire decade of R&D time for designers to work on the electroacoustic side of the loudspeaker array. And you'll see how that progresses here in the next few slides. Let's quickly blow through a couple of installations. This was one of the world's first large-scale computer control installations, 1991, commissioned at the Kremlin. EQ, delay, and power amplifiers, three different networks, three different PCs, three different operators. You can see two of the gentlemen smiling, and in the background you see there's a third PC right there. Then there's a Tonemeister sitting in front of that control window out in the 7,000-seat room. If he wanted to make a change to delay, amplitude of a speaker zone, or EQ, he got on the headset and talked to one of these three people. That's how they did it. Well, in live sound, which a number of us are interested in, integration attempts for large-scale speaker systems, it was an unsustainable trend. Here you see seven separate computers as this particular mixing engineer for the Neil Diamond tour in 1992, as he wanted to control everything with computers, this is what the mix booth looked like. So we've seen Crest, we've seen Crown, that was an IQ system, and now here we see Q's control. QSC was one of the first companies to look at outside vendors, and MediaLink, a multimedia networking program with a common GUI. You could use either a PC or a Mac, fiber optic links, and a planned migration path to low latency digital audio transport. This was the University of Nebraska Memorial Stadium. So you had three or four different competing manufacturers on one control network with a single PC. Well, right at that time, we got to 94, and the Computer Controlled Sound System Conference was staged. There was big shift in the air to Ethernet-based technology, and increasing expectations were being placed on the standards efforts, WG10 working group. Here you can see the closing comment of that conference. The industry requires hardware and protocol standards to control and monitor audio equipment. Today, there are many different computer control systems, proprietary and incompatible. Other companies began to sense an opportunity to help provide technical solutions. 1994 Echelon's LawnWorks program was successful with Meyer Sound's RMS, remote monitoring system, Apogee Sound's AmpNet, and Rankus Heinz R-Control, which, Ralph, I think you still have that platform today. So that was a durable control-only platform 20-some years ago. Fast Ethernet came on the scene. 2 months later, October, Harman Professional announced that they were going to develop a proprietary communications architecture. Forget about this trying to be standardized with all of our competitors. So by December, MediaLink announced withdrawal from the pro audio industry. And the following spring, 96, QSC became the first licensee of CobraNet. So you can see how quickly some of these things were happening. SC10, you can't quite read the writing there, but it says, let's bring it all together, audio networking. The SC10 Standards Committee for Computer Control of Sound Systems was trying to keep up with these rapid developments in the industry. By 2001, EtherSound from Digigram was introduced, Ethernet-based protocol. Licensees started to pile on. 2005, the industry's first self-powered arrayable line array speaker with digital connectivity that could connect with other product classes. That was the JBL VT4889 DP, CN, CobraNet, DP, DrivePack Electronics. So multiple product classes controlled from a single user interface. The user interface challenge we saw downstairs within the last hour. Graham showed us some screen captures from VNet, which Tannoy uses. Every one of the audio equipment manufacturers today has had to wrestle with this challenge. What platform do I use to give my customers something with which to control my company's products? So this was an example. The HiQnet system had System Architect, which integrated both the predictive tools, including that room layout, along with the configuration of the individual devices. Leveraging Ethernet advanced protocols by 2006, Audinate had developed Dante, yet another licensed set of software, hardware, and network protocols. Large licensee group, many names that we see and recognize: Bosch, Bose, EAW, IED, PV, QSC. 2009, AVB, audio video bridging, IEEE standard. Based, and the promoters originally included Broadcom, Cisco, Intel, Harman, and Xilinx. Those of you who are interested in this somewhat arcane topic probably already noticed that just 2 months ago, they completely redid the Avenue Alliance makeup, and both Intel and Cisco have now appointed vice president-level senior technologists as president and technical chair of Avenue Alliance. So that's something interesting to keep watching. Well, this brings up open or closed network systems. If we're really going to treat this loudspeaker, assuming it's powered, as an endpoint device on a network, and as Bob McCarthy showed us earlier today, the network is the future. What standard do we use? What technology platform, if I'm with an equipment manufacturer, what platform can I reliably base my commercial products on? So these are questions that the business team at every manufacturer has to carefully consider. Recent efforts within the Standards Committee, and you can see the timeline here. Just 5 years ago, X192 study for achieving interoperability of networked audio. 2012, Open Control Architecture Alliance formed as a trade organization to help support that. 2013, AES67 standard was released. 2014, Media Networking Alliance established and announced at the Los Angeles convention. AES X210, Open Control Architecture, is working with the Standards Committee as possibly ratifying OCA 1.3 as a public open standard. So you can see complex interlinked activity, many acronyms. But what about the loudspeaker? If the loudspeaker is really an endpoint device on a network, and if there are no robust, open, commonly available standards, what does the system designer do? That takes us back in time again to 1994. It was realized that control networks, digital audio transport, and customized software interfaces would all need to make progress if products of that type were going to come about. So you needed advancements on several fronts. Now, if you think about the loudspeakers that are used, and that picture I showed you on the first slide, passive boxes and traditional amplifiers. You have your amps on the ground, your speakers either up on the chain motor hoists or up on scaffolding. The evolution to control networks, which then started adding digital audio in the network, like the current products from companies like Camco, Lab Group, and Crown. Most major manufacturers have smart amplifier platform now. That shifts the DSP into the amplifier. And then, of course, if you have a smart powered speaker, like a good example would be Cal, the column from Meyer Sound, where you have the DSP in the speaker, or Dr. Start's Intellivox from Duran Audio, you begin to have the ability to adjust the signal and the resulting output from that loudspeaker by addressing each transducer individually. So for controlling traditional unpowered speakers, a network-ready device, a dual-channel power amplifier, thank you, Kurt, was shown, but of great interest to many people. EAW proposed to integrate the DSP units, network interface, monitoring sensors, and all of the amplification inside each speaker. And once again, that was 21 years ago. So it took a while. Array beam steering could be accomplished, according to those authors, if two or more identical transducers were separately circuited and amplified. Well, let's look at a timeline here as we get close to a summary. The traditional arrays, you can see from 1980 up until that conference in 94, and the dotted blue line represents 1994, we had the research going on for modular line array elements. We had the release of a self-powered array box. We had self-powered line arrays. We had the first networked audio line array. And then we have, starting in 2010, networked beam steerable line arrays for this market. It didn't happen overnight, and I'll skip over some of this, but suffice to say that in 1967, this is what powered speakers looked like from the world's two leading companies, JBL and Altec Lansing. The Energizer and Altec's device, their innovation was to put a handle on the back and wheels on the bottom, so you had a portable self-powered speaker. In my paper that you all will be able to read when downloading these conference proceedings, you'll find an interesting presentation from 42nd Convention, and those are 7 foot tall, self-powered loudspeakers that were used for top touring artist Al Siniskal's paper from Spectrasonics in 1972. Well, I mentioned in 94, we had this conference in Dallas. We had a disruptive technology, the line array, and we had a powered speaker that finally commanded professional attention. Meyer's MSL4 began to shift the sentiment in the user group. This, of course, over the next decade, led to OEM subassemblies from many vendors, from Bang & Olufsen to Power Physics, PowerSoft. Here's that blue box I mentioned, and Ben Koch here at the conference, I'm sure, can tell you great detail, way ahead of its time. The broader industry still knew very little about measurement, and I'll skip over this. There you see a Brühl and Kayer application note, which happened shortly after Meyer had developed the SIM system. Every speaker manufacturer began to try to measure these speakers, and the whole issue was, how do I tell my customers where to put them in the array and where to point them? The disruptive technology, of course, I talked about. In 92, Heil Acoustics told the Audio Engineering Society about the theory. In 1994, the VDOS system was released. And then from 99 to the present, Every major speaker manufacturer has adopted that paradigm. This makes the user interface challenge much more complicated, and you can imagine the reasons for that if you need accuracy and predictability consistently. OEM supply of tools along that front. New frontier, adaptive algorithms, things that have been around a long time with automatic mic mixers now begin to let adjacent line arrays communicate with each other and sense their proximity. So I'll wrap this up. What's possible today? Four key milestones have been achieved. We now have the ability to integrate control and digital audio, and we have a greater widespread acceptance of self-powered boxes. There are two systems. I'll give you one slide apiece. You can read the detail in my paper. Martin MLA, it's already been 5 years since it was introduced. The boxes on the in blue is what the user can adjust. Everything else is inside the black box. But the key here is you have mechanically variable splay angles with electronically steerable array characteristics. 2013, just 2 years ago, EAW, and I show you not a large array, but one element, this heat sink, is actually dissipating the thermal output from 22 separate power amplifiers. So we have a vision of interoperability that may or may not come to pass. We have the differences of the input side, where the mixing console has many, many, many active control commands during the performance, and the output side, where you configured it and it's pretty much set it and leave it during the show. So, in summary, predictions. An increasing number of specialty OEM vendors, such as Onert Feistel Media Group with EaseFocus, Pascal and Bang & Olufsen with commonly available amplifier subassemblies. Information about this will enable more new, smaller entrepreneurial companies to make progress in this area. Ever more intelligent adaptive algorithms may even start to respond to the program material that the loudspeakers are being used for. System operators will have an access to an increasing number of branded systems of this type. AES standards efforts and industry R&D efforts will continue to converge, but this issue of everything connected to everything will remain elusive. Number 6 out of 7, the shortening of product life cycles and shifting trends will make every equipment manufacturer's and system developer's job more challenging. The broad-based shift to these smart, beam-steerable, tour-grade line arrays may not happen unless and until the largest global vendors who currently supply so many clients with their own custom systems. If a company like that shifts to this paradigm, that may be a tipping point. So, in conclusion, over the course of these decades, increasing DSP power has enabled even large-scale, portable, set-it-up-the-same-day type systems to start to steer the beam, as the gentleman showed us in the last session. And in the future, I look back on this very conference and some of these ideas being developed and presented in these papers will be interesting exercise for future practitioners to look back on. Thank you.